The killing of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and the U.S. dramatic escalation in the Middle East. What it means today on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. With support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
The end of Julian Castro's presidential bid may signal the beginning of his new political career. We explore how the cost of housing has prompted a new era of student activism in the capital city. We look at 150 years of construction at the U.S.-Mexico border, one of the most dramatic transformations of our landscape, and a story so wild one prosecutor called it the most lavish scam he had ever seen. All that and more. This is the Texas Standard. U.S. allies are asking the U.S. and Iran to de-escalate. Welcome to the Texas Standard. Thank you for spending some of your time with us. It's Friday, the 3rd of January, and I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. No matter where you are in the Lone Star State, I'm sure you've heard the U.S. has killed one of Iran's most powerful men, General Qasem Soleimani, in an overnight strike. Relations between the U.S. and Iran have been tense for some time now, but things took a turn for the worse in December when a U.S. contractor was killed in Iraq. Yesterday's strike on Soleimani sounds like war, but it is not war. So how can we read this move? What we know is that this is a dramatic escalation by the U.S. in the Middle East. President Trump approved the move without notifying Congress, and the president can definitely do that. But while it's a legal option for the president, there are some conditions to be met beforehand. Here to talk to us about those and what happens next is Jeremy Suri. He's a professor of history at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He also leads the public leadership program at the LBJ School. Professor Suri, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Please tell us what's going on right now.
So we've seen a rapid escalation in a long-existing U.S.-Iranian conflict in the Middle East. The Iranians have been using their military force in Iraq and elsewhere to try to limit American power in the region and attack American assets. And in response, the United States has been using air power, most recently a set of airstrikes last week, and then an airstrike most recently that killed the leader of the Iranian Revolutionary Quds Force, essentially the second most powerful person in all of Iran.
We know that this is not a declaration of war, but it looks very similar. And this is within the abilities and the legal abilities of the president. How can the American people read this, Jeremy?
Well, this is close to an act of war. It's basically a statement by the United States government that it believes the military leadership of Iran is at war with the United States and faces an imminent threat, that they are basically creating an imminent threat against American force. That's the justification for the president using military force in this way.
Jeremy, I know that you're boarding a plane, you're on your way out, but can you clarify this? The U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo told CNN this morning that the airstrikes that killed General Soleimani saved American lives. Let's take a listen.
The President Trump's decision to remove Qasem Soleimani from the battlefield saved American lives. There's no doubt about that. He was actively plotting in the region to take actions, a big action as he described it, that would have put dozens, if not hundreds, of American lives at risk. We know it was imminent. This was an intelligence-based assessment that drove our decision-making process.
How can we read that?
Well, the claim that the Secretary of State is making is that the Iranian military leadership was about to launch a military activity that would have killed a large number of Americans. What we don't know is what that threat was, and we don't know why killing the leader of the Iranian military will forestall that operation. Some are concerned that this will actually increase the level of violence used by Iran against American forces. Every branch of the American government today is bracing for Iranian retaliation. So we don't know what Secretary of State Pompeo was referring to, nor do we know why the killing of Soleimani will make Americans safer.
This feels very similar to the George W. Bush administration and the war, the events leading to attacking Iraq. How does it feel to you?
Well, it does feel similar in that we're seeing a rapid escalation of force and an assertion that a government in the Middle East poses a direct threat to the United States. What is different is this was an airstrike. This was not the mobilization of the full American military, and it wasn't a declaration of war, at least not yet.
What happens next?
Well, I think there will be retaliation from Iran, and what we have to hope is that there will be an effort by both the United States and the Iranian leadership to control the escalation, to prevent this from escalating into war. Prior crises like this in other parts of the world and in this part of the world have escalated into war in the past, and we have to hope that we have good diplomatic efforts on both sides to manage the rising use of force.
Jeremy Suri is a professor of history at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He also leads the Public Leadership Program at the LBJ School. Jeremy, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
Julian Castro's dream is to be the first Latino president, but his run for the White House this time around ended on Thursday. Castro suspended his campaign 1 month before the Iowa caucuses. And as Texas Public Radio's Joey Palacios reports, this may be the beginning of Castro's new political face.
A son of San Antonio, Julian Castro said he didn't grow up as a presidential frontrunner, but that was part of his fight. On Thursday, after almost a year of campaigning, he told supporters it was not his time. Appearing on MSNBC with Rachel Maddow, Castro went deeper into the decision of ending his bid.
It just became clear that we didn't have the resources, didn't have the organization because of the lack of resources. Mm.
Castro consistently scored in the low single digits in most national polls. It's those polling numbers that kept him off the last two debate stages.
Certainly there are things that we could have done better in the campaign, and we're going to have a lot of time to think through that. But it also is about timing and the mood of the Democratic Party.
Castro did fare better in Univision polls of likely Latino voters, polling above 10% in June and September, but he still trailed Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. Although Castro's message did not resonate as well as he had hoped, this is likely not his swan song, according to Henry Flores, a political science professor emeritus at San Antonio's St. Mary's University.
He's got name recognition now. He knows what kind of a national organization is required. He knows how much money is absolutely required to put one together. He knows what he needs to say. He knows what he cannot say.
Castro, who is 45, has his age to his advantage, Flores says, which would give him time to make another bid in 4 or 8 years.
Julian will only be 53 in 8 years. By that time, he can lay a foundation, develop a national network that will help get him elected to office. I think this time around was a good kind of boot camp for him.
The former San Antonio mayor had his moments of spotlight in the race, taking a hard stance against President Trump's family separation policies. Here's Castro at a rally he held in San Antonio the same day Trump was visiting the Alamo City in April.
About a year ago, this administration told us that if we could just be cruel enough to separate these little children from their parents, that would deter more families from coming to the United States. And instead, more families are coming now.
Castro took a reform approach to immigration. In June, he and fellow Texan Beto O'Rourke verbally sparred over repealing a law that criminalizes border crossings and limits the number of daily asylum cases.
Some of us on this stage have called to end that section, to terminate it. Some, like Congressman O'Rourke, have not.
We're looking at just one small part of this. I'm talking about a comprehensive rewrite of our immigration
laws.
That's
not true. And
in October, he walked asylum seekers from Matamoros, Mexico, into the United States. He was the only candidate to visit Matamoros to see the growing humanitarian crisis there for himself. Castro's campaign suspension comes a month short of the Iowa caucuses, a political barometer for support in the primaries. But late in his campaign, Castro raised concerns that Iowa and New Hampshire being first limited non-white candidates, a point he made on MSNBC last night.
You start your nominating process in two states that are some of the whitest states that lack people of color.
Henry Flores, political science professor, says that's a fair assessment, and states with more racial diversity should go first.
Perhaps California should go first, as opposed to Iowa, for instance. And there's such small population states that a candidate will waste a lot of resources, and if people vote along racial lines, a minority candidate will end up last every time, use up all the resources, and be perceived by the national media as a loser.
Although Castro's run is over, the bid can still resonate with Latinos. Henry Cisneros is also a former mayor of San Antonio and a former housing secretary like Castro.
Only in America can a young man grow up in tough circumstances and fight his way through the best colleges in the country and gain experience to become the leader of his community and then run for president of the United States.
At the end of his MSNBC appearance, Castro offered no endorsements of the remaining candidates, but said he would support the eventual Democratic nominee. I'm Joy Palacios in San Antonio.
That sound announces that social media editor Wells Dunbar is here with the Talk of Texas. Welcome, Wells.
Hi, Joy. Lots to talk about. The assassination of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani sparking lots of talk on Twitter and social media, with many concerned, about the repercussions the killing will create. On Twitter, terms related to war all trending, even terms like Dick Cheney and WMDs trending as well, Joy. I found this interesting.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Yes, with many commenters contextualizing this strike and basically, the current lack of information from the Pentagon is similar to the run-up to the Iraq War. Meanwhile, over on our Facebook page, Stephen St. Clair is curious if this constitutes an act of war, asking that very question. Bill Gross says that Soleimani has been a source of trouble in the Middle East for a long while. He says this time we went after the chief troublemaker rather than people much lower down in his organization. Bill calls it calls the assassination the best example of an appropriate and measured response. Many people tying Soleimani's work with Iran to past incidents, the USS Cole bombing and other incidents. However,
he had a long career,
Yes. Quite some time there, as we heard earlier. Meanwhile, M. Paul Lewis says that President Trump is best at poking others in the eye rather than seek peace and actually solving disagreements. He only knows how to confront and destabilize. Then he tries to take credit when the problem he created gets partially resolved, leaving us worse off than before.
Ouch. And,
Paul goes on to say that no doubt the Iranian general was no friend of the USA or other nations in the region, but doing this now and in this way does nothing to make the region safer or more peaceful. And many other people continue this ongoing conversation about just exactly who was briefed, who knew this was coming. Lots more questions than answers, really, at this point, Joy.
Yes, join the conversation at Texas Standard on Twitter or find us on Facebook. We want to hear your thoughts. Email us at texasstandard@kut.org. This is the Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises. Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com. Available in the dairy aisle.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. The University of Texas at Austin, historically speaking, has been an affordable place for students. Students could show up on their first semester and find a cheap place to live, but not anymore. Since 2010, the median monthly rent in Austin has risen from roughly $900 to $1,300. So when the Austin City Council took two big votes this fall on measures related to student housing, you better believe that students showed up. They protested and testified. But as KUT's Audrey McGlinchey reports, some wondered, where was the university?
A group of UT Austin students stood in front of city council members this past October.
Good evening. My name is Cameron Goodman, and I am the student body president at the University of Texas at Austin.
Goodman was there asking council members to vote no on a new development in East Riverside. The result would be that five apartment complexes, all of which house UT students looking for cheap rent, would be torn down.
And to express the voice and the concern of the 50,000 plus students on campus.
Council members ended up supporting the redevelopment, meaning that student housing on East Riverside will come down. A month later, students showed up to City Hall again, this time to ask council members to vote for more housing in West Campus.
As the Democratic Party Club at UT, we care about ensuring that UT students can live in healthy and affordable communities.
However, as the city of Austin grows and previously affordable areas in our city become unaffordable for students, many Longhorns will face the challenge.
Supporting student renters is key to ensuring healthy growth for our city and affordable housing for all. And I urge all of you.
The council agreed to add more housing, but not as much as the students asked for. Malik Julian is a UT student. He was at City Hall for the East Riverside vote and wondered, hey, students showed up. Where's the university?
The university hasn't been as proactive as I think they should be or as they could be.
Right now, Julian pays $545 a month for a bedroom and a bathroom all to himself. That's in one of the apartment buildings now slated to be torn down. Julian has most of his tuition and fees covered by UT and gets a little extra from grants to pay rent. He works 15 hours a week to afford utilities. The loss of cheap housing has him worried for low-income students like himself.
You're making it harder for these students to study and have the same opportunities as people who don't have the same worries of where they're going to live.
Again, wondering, where is the university on all this?
At a student government meeting last February, an economics government double major named Omar Rios asked me a question about housing.
UT Austin President Greg Fenves gave his annual address in September. It was the first time he mentioned student housing in one of his speeches.
He said the high rents in Austin were a significant concern for many students. And he asked me what the university was doing about it. It was a great question.
Fenves went on to lay out what the university's doing. They've hired a consultant. They're renovating two buildings, adding up to 1,400 beds on campus.
These actions mark the beginning of an effort to improve access to housing for students. It will take time to get it right, but our goals are clear. If a student can't afford to live in Austin, that's a barrier to success.
A spokesperson told KUT that the university's work is more behind the scenes, that the university's been in talks with the city about ways to partner on affordable student housing. But student body president Cameron Goodman says students will keep pushing.
I think time and time again, the university only moves its foot when students move their foot.
For the Texas Standard, I'm Audrey McGlinchey.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. The headline in the Dallas Morning News sounds like it was ripped from a page of Mad Libs. Con men scam $1 million from isolated Mennonite craftsmen by claiming to be the Illuminati. But the story is very real. One prosecutor called it the most lavish fraud he'd ever seen, and it takes place in Kaufman County, just east of Dallas. Here to tell us more is Kevin Krause. He's a federal courts reporter for the Dallas Morning News. Hi, Kevin.
Thanks very much.
Can we start by talking about the people who are involved in the story?
Yes, absolutely. This is a isolated Mennonite cabinet maker in rural Kaufman County who was victimized by two men. One is an older, middle-aged former stockbroker, and his accomplice, a car thief in his 20s, whose only prior work experience was fast food.
So you're talking about Johnny Clifton and Joshua Pugh. So these are the two scammers. And what is the scheme? What did they do to this cabinet maker?
Well, they were just absolutely relentless. They did extensive research on this mythical group called the Illuminati, which most people have probably seen in movies and TV shows.
Right.
This individual, this victim, had no clue about any of this. He had no TV. He, because of his religion, he knew nothing about popular culture or the modern world. And
right.
They pressured him to invest in this bogus organization by saying that they had access to world leaders and they control the world with elite families. And then when he realized that it was a scam, they put pressure, intense pressure on him not to report it to the authorities and even threatened him with violence.
When this prosecutor was talking about lavish scam, and, you know, I read that helicopters were involved and vehicles painted in black, and just it truly shows that these two men went all out in their intimidation techniques.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've been covering federal courts and con men and scam artists for years, and I had never seen anything as elaborate as this either. You know, they hired off-duty police officers for security. You know, they were driving a Bentley, the helicopter, and they did the research, I'll say that. And this victim had money because he saved and he didn't have any debts. And, you know, one thing I wish I knew was how they found this person. Maybe that'll come out in the second sentencing hearing.
And his name is Clifford Stauffer, right?
Yes, exactly. I was able to get an interview with him, although he was not at the first sentencing hearing, and he's most likely will not show up for the second. He's a very private individual, and you know, he is, according to his pastor, embarrassed about what happened.
Oh, I'm sure.
He seemed very gentle, but very forgiving because of his he's a deeply religious person.
Yeah,
and I was surprised, but he was very forgiving, and he's never going to see a dime of that money.
Oh my goodness, I was going to ask you about restitution, if there was a chance for that.
Well, the judge did order restitution in the case, but both men are, indigent. They have no money left. All of the ill-gotten gains were spent, and they're going to be spending years in prison. And so the agents even told the victim not to expect any money, unfortunately.
Kevin, what happens to Mr. Stauffer now? I mean, you said he's a very forgiving man, but what about his life going forward? What about his business?
Well, his business is still going strong, and he is an expert at what he does, an expert craftsman. And hopefully he's a little bit wiser now that this happened, but I don't see him changing his ways. He's going to continue on. He's got a business that looks like it's doing pretty well. And he's learned a big lesson. Hopefully he'll be able to move on with his life.
Kevin Krause is a federal courts reporter for the Dallas Morning News. And we'll have a link to his story at texasstandard.org. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Services begin tonight for an East Texas sheriff's deputy killed in the line of duty earlier this week. Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner has more.
The visitation for Panola County Deputy Chris Dickerson starts at 5:30 this evening at the Carthage Civic Center. The funeral service will then be held Saturday afternoon in the same location. Dickerson was shot and killed during an early morning traffic stop Tuesday. His death brings the total number of officer fatalities in Texas last year to 18, the most of any state in the U.S.
Sasha Cordner reporting. Several Texas Republicans in Congress are praising the U.S. killing of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani in Iraq. Houston area Representative Dan Crenshaw tweeted, quote, "It's a great day for the fight against evil in this world." U.S. Senator Ted Cruz and Congressman Roger Williams and Michael McCaul also voiced support for the strike ordered by President Trump. A museum in France is honoring an Austin filmmaker for his works that tackle what the museum calls the American nightmare. KUT's Jennifer Staten has more on the Filming Time as Material exhibit.
The exhibit about Richard Linklater at the Centre Pompidou in Paris is the first time all 26 of his films are being presented together. Linklater founded the Austin Film Society in 1985 as a way to engage in film culture while he was still learning the craft. The Austin film scene, and AFS specifically, are included in the exhibit. The organization's CEO, Rebecca Campbell, says Linklater's career provides rich material.
The curators were fascinated by the fact that Richard has been able to maintain his independent voice and yet thrive within the industry. They also felt that the themes that come up in his work over and over again, such as time, an entire zeitgeist expressed in a film that takes place over a few hours, or conversely, a film where 12 years passes in the space of 2 hours.
The exhibit runs at the Pompidou through January 6th.
And that's Jennifer Staten reporting. Wheat crops in the Texas Panhandle are feeling the effects of months of drought. Dr. Jordan Bell is with the Texas A&M AgriLife Research and Extension Office in Amarillo.
Because of the dry conditions throughout the fall, many farmers just did not have a good planting window and did not want to, as they call it, dry sow or dry plant that wheat. And so that has impacted some of the wheat planting across the panhandle as well.
More than a third of Texas remains in drought, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
You're listening to the Texas Standard, and I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. In 1792, the U.S. was a young country, only sweet 16, and right around that time, the Farmer's Almanac went to print for the first time. It was a publication that predicted the weather, had remedies for health ailments, and even published the distances between popular destinations, kind of like a Google Maps of the era. Well, the almanac is still in print today, but now we call it the Old Farmer's Almanac, and Ben Kilbride is part of the editorial team. Ben, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'd love to talk a little bit about the latest issue, because it has folk remedies, it has a calendar, and by the way, I learned that my birthday is going to be on a Monday, and that it's around the time when little brown bats start hibernating. I mean, you talk about so many things in this one. How have you kept the almanac so relevant?
We've continued to do what's been good and strong, and then we've continued to move forward with what people are looking for these days. So gardening advice. We also have an article every year about different farmers around the country where we kind of interview them and get to know a little background so people know, who's growing their food these days, which is very important. We always mix in a lot of really fun stuff like, how dogs are training people.
Yeah, right.
Which is extremely true because, you're definitely not teaching your dog anything. And then, going on to, we've got a good article about National Park in here.
You talk about noise and almost like a history of how noise affected us in the past and hundreds of years ago, and even how it affects us today, but how it's useful for certain things and just common interest things, I guess.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and that's what's so great about it is you can kind of pick up the almanac any time of the year and you'll find something new and interesting and you'll learn something different.
So one of the things that is interesting is that when so many print publications have died, that the almanac survives. Are you finding new readers or are you surviving with your legacy readers?
A little of both. We have people who call in who will be like, my grandfather used to read the almanac to me when I was a kid. And then we're also getting new readers. We're on Instagram and Pinterest, and we're constantly updating those pages. Also on our website, you can find where to buy the almanac, or you can just go to Amazon if that makes it easier.
So let's talk about the weather, because of course, in the olden days, the almanac was heavily used to forecast the weather. And I've read about brides writing in and saying, what's the best day in this month where I can get married? Even today, the weather is one of the things that you guys excel at. Why is it?
So back when it was first started in 1792, Robert B. Thomas had a knack for predicting weather. He based his predictions heavily off of sunspots.
That was fascinating to me. I was like, what are sunspots?
Yeah, so if you don't know what sunspots are, they're kind of, geothermic storms, like magnetic storms on the sun's surface, which basically can disrupt the output of energy, I guess. Sunspots can have an effect on the weather that we have here on a global scale. If there are more sunspots, you can expect more frequency of heavy storms and changes in weather. And if there are fewer, like right now, then you can expect less.
I mentioned that you have a good track record. I mean, it's like 85% of your predictions are actually correct, and you don't do it solely with sunspots anymore. You have like the latest technology that everybody else has. But one of the things that I find fascinating is horrible, devastating events like Hurricane Harvey. Is that something that the Almanac can predict or is predicting or is looking at?
So we can, and we do look into that heavily and try and predict those. They're also one of the hardest things to predict because they're extremely volatile, and there are a lot more of them happening, and they're, you know, they're much more devastating these days.
How did you arrive at the Almanac?
So I was traveling across the country a couple of years ago with the WOOF program, which is Willing Workers on Organic Farms, and basically with that, you volunteer at a number of, you know, over a couple thousand farms across the United States. After that, I kind of got back to my home area, the Monadnock region, where the Almanac is produced. And I got a call from an old teacher who works here, and he said that there
because
was a
you're a writer, a professional
I'm
writer.
I'm a writer. I went to college for writing, and I said there might be a job here. So I came in and checked it out, and it was a great fit because I had all this passion and interest in farming. And
I would credit Texas for that because I think you probably came through Texas on.
I absolutely did. Yeah, I drove through. I stopped at the Cadillac Ranch, and Texas is quite beautiful. I had no idea.
Ben Kilbride is part of the editorial team that produces the Old Farmer's Almanac. Ben, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
I used to read the Farmer's Almanac at my grandparents' house in Mexico. They were farmers, and the almanac continues to feel like a connection to them. This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. One of the blessings of being the state with the longest border with Mexico is that Texas is constantly on the news. I guess it's a bit of a blessing and a curse. 2019 was no exception. The happenings at the U.S.-Mexico border topped the news, in part because of that promise President Trump made to have a border wall. But the issue of the boundary between the U.S. and Mexico and the issue of building on the border is hardly a new phenomenon. C.J. Alvarez explores 150 years of history along the border. His new book, Borderland, Border Water, takes a look at barriers, surveillance, and river engineering projects. C.J. Alvarez is also Assistant Professor of Mexican-American and Latino-Latina Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. C.J., thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
Let's look at why 150 years. I mean, obviously, both countries are older than that. So why 150 years? Why start during this time period?
Well, you know, there's two answers to that question. One of the most common responses I get from people when I tell them I write about the border and I write about building projects on the border is they say, oh, that's such a relevant topic. But I grew up down by the border, and for us, it's always been a relevant topic, like notwithstanding the current political climate. And the second answer to your question is I'm a historian. And so from my point of view, whenever I look out into the world and try to understand political or social or cultural or environmental developments, I look to the past to try to understand what the genealogy, what the lineage is that brought us to the point that we're at today.
Absolutely.
And so from my point of view, I had to go back to when the U.S.-Mexico border was first demarcated, starting in 1848, and then continually became the site of more and more construction over the course of 150 years.
Mm-hmm. One of the focus of your book is the Mexican Revolution, and it's such an interesting period. I mean, for some people, they may remember that the battles were filmed from one side of the border to the next. What interested you about the Mexican Revolution during, you know, with this focus of construction on the border?
Well, I mean, as you well know, the Mexican Revolution is fascinating. And on the border, what's so fascinating about it is that because so many Americans were so heavily invested in mining, agriculture, ranching, these sorts of like capital intensive industries in Mexico, they were very worried that they might lose their properties. And so the U.S. government sent at its peak in 1917 160,000 soldiers to the border. So we often think about the borders being militarized today. That's a common
like a new thing.
Hear. Yeah. But in fact, the moment when the border was most militarized was actually during the Mexican Revolution.
Wow.
And part of what that meant in the context of building, the building project then was not fences. It was not dams or big mega projects like we see in later in the 20th century, but it was actually roads.
Right.
Which seems like not a very, you know, dramatic thing, but that's actually one of the most important kinds of building projects on the U.S.-Mexico region.
One of the most fascinating photos that you have in the book is precisely focused on these remote areas, how it required a lot to put a marker that this is where the border goes, and they're climbing this super steep mountain, I guess.
Yeah, out in Arizona.
Unbelievable.
Arizona and Sonora. Yeah.
Unbelievable. So what has been built along the border?
Earlier fencing projects, watchtowers that the Border Patrol used before they developed high-tech cameras and radar and that sort of thing. Just as interestingly, just as importantly, lots and lots of hydraulic engineering.
Absolutely.
Projects.
We have a lot of dams built around the
exactly. And Texans understand that, especially the Texans who live around the border with our sister states of Chihuahua, Coahuila, Nuevo León, Tamaulipas, right. Understand that really well, of just how difficult it is to both manage an international border and an international border that happens to be a river.
Right. The resources that are there. Yeah. Yeah. So one for us who are in Texas, but of course you didn't write the book for Texans. You wrote the book for anyone who is interested in learning more about this border. And one of the things that I thought was fascinating is that you mentioned that, you know, the majority of people in the United States are participating in this debate about the border when it's a place that they don't know, they've never been here. Why did you think it was important to talk about that?
Well, I think that so many times today when people talk about the border, they're not really talking about places along the international divide. They're talking about immigration policy and immigration enforcement policy.
I see.
And that's a very important conversation that we desperately need to have and that we desperately need to address and confront in all of its aspects. But for those of us like myself who actually grew up and have been in the border region for generations, what I tried to do was remind people and capture the fact that even though the border is a site of international migration, long-distance migration, both authorized and unauthorized, it's still a place where like border people live. And that each one of the different places along this 2,000-mile border are actually quite distinct environmentally. They're quite distinct culturally in many ways. And one of the ways to get at that is to look at building projects, because the building projects are so customized to the specific region of the international divide.
What did you find, for instance?
Well, I think that one of the most extreme modifications on the entire international border is between El Paso, Texas, and Ciudad Juarez, Chihuahua. And the reason I say it's extreme is not because of the fence, although there is one of the there is a very large barrier infrastructure there,
right.
Since 2006.
Brown metallic structures.
Yeah, exactly. That weathering steel. And of course, now they put concertina wire on top and that sort of thing. But before that fence was built, the most dramatic modification of the landscape there was actually in the riverbed, because that's the point when the land border in the western states becomes the river border,
right.
In Texas. And not only does it become a river border, but that river is a desert river. And rivers in the desert tend to move their channels.
That is so fascinating, yeah.
And so basically, you think about it as like...
Because it's alive.
Yeah, it's alive and not so well anymore, but it was once alive and well. And if you think about it from that perspective, you couldn't choose a worse...
border.
Yeah, exactly, than a movable river to be an international border that's, of course, borders are supposed to hold still.
And so if you go to El Paso Juarez today, what you will see is that the river channel has been encased in concrete.
Right.
Which is about the most dramatic thing you can do to a watershed other than building big storage dams, of which we have two.
Right.
Between Texas and Mexico.
CJ Alvarez is the author of Borderland, Border Water, A History of Construction on the U.S.-Mexico Divide. CJ, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
I am Jody Edgerton, and I'm with the Typewriter Rodeo. And we are a group that crafts custom poems on vintage typewriters. You give us a word, an idea, a phrase, something you'd like a poem about, and we will write you a poem on the spot. Winter sports in Texas. Put on your woolen hat and grab your cozy mittens, too. Let's gather up to watch some sports the way we Texans do. It's wintertime, so winter sports must be the way to go, like hockey, skiing, bobsledding. I honestly don't know. It turns out most Texas sports run spring, summer, and fall, but winter, hey, it's 72 degrees. Let's go play some football. I'm Jody Edgerton, and you're on Texas Standard Time.
Support for the Typewriter Rodeo comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
You can catch the Typewriter Rodeo each Friday or anytime on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and send us your Typewriter Rodeo requests on social media or email TexasStandard@KUT.org. Switching gears, the week wouldn't be complete without checking in with Alex Samuels. She's political reporter for the Texas Tribune. Hey, Alex, are you ready to talk about the week that was in Texas politics?
Of course, always ready.
I love it. Hey, there are no more Texans in the presidential race. Julian Castro announced yesterday he was stepping down. And I think one thing that was interesting was that his poll numbers in Texas were never that high. And yet, some analysts are saying he's worth more stepping down than running. Why is that?
Yeah, as you mentioned, his poll numbers never really cracked above low single digits, whether nationally or here in Texas. He was always sort of overshadowed by Beto O'Rourke, which is fascinating because, of course, we know that his presidential bid outlasted that of O'Rourke's.
Right.
But as we reported in our story, Castro made the decision to step down over the holidays, just realizing that fundraising and polling-wise, I don't think he realized that he could perform well in the Iowa caucuses.
Now, let's talk about Michael Bloomberg. It's very interesting how he's ramping up his efforts in Texas.
Mm-hmm. So, his campaign gave us a call a couple days ago just sharing that they're going to open a Texas headquarters in Houston and 16 field offices throughout the rest of the state between now and the March 3rd primary. And those offices will literally be spread all across Texas. So we go from Houston to DFW to Austin to East Texas, San Antonio, to down in the border. He also named a Texas state director, which was pretty significant. He's only the third presidential candidate to do that behind Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren. So he's definitely ramping up his efforts in the state. And, you know, he's previously said that he plans to skip the four early voting states and instead focus on the Super Tuesday states, which, of course, include Texas.
Oh, wow. I did not mention that he is one of the Democratic presidential candidates. Do you know how much he's investing in Texas?
The Houston Chronicle had a story, I believe the same day that as we did, that he had spent more than $7.8 million on TV ads here in Texas. And $4 million of that was in Houston alone. I don't have updated numbers on that, but he's really investing a lot of his, he's a billionaire, obviously investing a lot of his money in the state. And obviously the media markets here are a little bit more expensive.
And there's also some news from you all, right? The Texas Tribune has the Texas primary ballot guide out. It's live and well and available for people to look at it. And it's not only the Democratic presidential race. You have a lot of state and local races that you're helping us keep up with. What can people find there?
Yeah, so our data team really hats off to them. They did a great job on this. They have a list of all the candidates who have filed for the Democratic and Republican primary elections, according to the Secretary of State. So each party will choose its candidate for president, as you mentioned, U.S. Senate, congressional and legislative offices. But we also have the State Board of Education, Railroad Commission, and judicial seats.
Wow. Okay. So that's a very good guide to go to and just to make an informed decision. Alex Samuels is political reporter for the Texas Tribune. And thank you so much for joining us today, Alex.
Yes, of course. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. Social media editor Wells Dunbar, welcome back.
Welcome back to me and you, Joy.
And the Texas Standard.
And all of our Texas Standard
listeners. And all
of our listeners,
yes.
You know, we've been hearing from our listeners about a certain topic called New Year's resolutions, believe it or not. Heard
of
those things before?
I sort of forgot about them like 5 years ago.
You know, I think some people have as well, judging by what we've been hearing from
what
people.
What our listeners are saying.
Although there are some resolutions out there we're hearing about
via
Facebook. Let's see, what do we have here? Josh Fredman says that his resolutions are going pretty well. He says he's trying to be more productive and he's angling towards some more larger scale projects. Meanwhile, Dana Rowan says she is driving less and walking more. I think that's something good to applaud there. Jose Fonseca says, more in line with what you were saying a moment ago there, Joy. He doesn't do resolutions. Either you do it or you don't.
That's right.
It's that simple. Meanwhile, Janice Dean Wright says she's already failed and I can quit trying now and enjoy the rest of the year. There's something to that, I feel like. Well, I gotta say, this new year kind of feels like it's gone on a couple months already.
Oh my gosh,
all the news,
it's day three.
International news,
it's been
news
crazy.
Close to home.
Yes.
Yeah, wild stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, and similarly, Kim Nahra, she says, I don't make resolutions because I end up breaking them. Life is complicated enough. And, echoing what we just heard, international concerns, things like that, life can be pretty darn complicated.
But sometimes it's really tempting. What about you? Do you have resolution?
Trying to just get into shape a little bit more. Shed a couple pounds, be a little more active, you know?
Yeah.
There's always parenting resolutions, you know, trying to be a better parent, I say, as I gaze upon a certain guest in the Texas Standard
we
control room.
We have Charlie
there.
In the house.
Yes,
thank you so much for visiting us.
Shout out to the AISD holiday schedule and its many, many days of time with the children there. Well, you know, it's not only the dawn of a new year, but a new decade as well. Or is it?
Or is it? I know.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
I think you know where
the
I'm
debate.
Going with this.
Yes.
An email from Robert Terry, a devoted listener from Fort Worth, stirs up a certain controversy. He reminds us that, yes, a decade commences with year one and ends at year 10. Hence, 2020 is not the start of a new decade, but the last year of a decade.
Okay.
The next decade will commence on January 1st, 2021.
Well, the thing that I like about the 2020 is the whole thing about vision, right? Vision 2020.
Right.
And so I started getting deep into that, like instead of a New Year's resolution and failing in that resolution, I just started thinking about 2020 as a challenge to have like a renewed vision of what I want and a renewed, you know, like a deeper understanding of where I am. And so I don't know, maybe you will do the same in 2020. Hopefully you will. And I'd love for you to join us online and join us on Twitter and join us on Facebook and email us at texasstandard@kut.org. And thank you so much for listening. Thank you for being here, Wells.
Anytime, Joy.
I'm Joy Diaz on behalf of David Brown.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family. Would your company or organization like to be a sponsor as well? Contact your local station for opportunities within your community. For statewide sponsorships, visit TexasPublicMediaNetwork.com.